My very great pleasure to present as our second speaker Professor Wendelin Werner from the University of Paris Sceaux, who, when he was a very young man, spent 2 years in Cambridge as a Leibniz Fellow between 1993 and 1995, and was awarded the Fields Medal, which many of you know is the highest form that a mathematician can achieve, in 2006. His doctorate was at the University of Pierre Marie Curie under the supervision of Legal, and he was a research officer at CNRS from 91 to 97. And in addition to the Fields Medal, he's received many other prizes and honors. He was Roland Davidson Prize winner in 1998, the Fermat Prize winner in 2001, the Love Prize winner in 2005, and the George Polyer Prize of the Siam in 2006. In 2008, he was elected to the huge distinction of being a member of the French Academy of Sciences. So, there's nothing more to be said. Wendelin Werner.
Thank you very much, and it's always a great pleasure to be here and to come back. Maybe before starting, I have to say that, you know, for those of you who were here when John was telling you who is sitting next to you, you know, presenting what the audience is, probably I was a bit scared because the description, I felt, you know, the variety of people in this room and made it sort of, I was starting to think, okay, good that I haven't prepared my lecture too much because I will be able to try to adapt sort of a bit better to trying to catch. Well, anyway, it's quite a scary audience to give a math lecture, especially since now sort of some specialists have popped in into the back of the room because they felt obliged to come. And anyway, so my experience, I mean, memory of the Newton Institute is also goes back close to its foundation, and I think it's always a very nice occasion when we celebrate the anniversary of an institution, because in some way the institution symbolizes also science itself that lives on, you know, individual paths and go, and the institutions hopefully, you know, and here of course in Cambridge you are very well placed to know that. Keep on, and some spirit of some what has happened in these different places continues to live on. And of course we all know the Peter's nice picture of Andrew Wiles sitting up being on this very podium, but it's sort of also symbolic of everything, you know, looking back at what science has achieved. And what the other thing, of course, is that Peter's account on the foundation makes us feel, I mean, all of us very grateful for not having to do it again, or sort of persuading us of never try to build or construct an institution again. And for those of us, for instance, in Paris or in Orsay, who are sort of struggling with the institutional reorganizations at the moment, we really feel like it's time to, you know, now's the moment to either stop either institutional organizations, or to walk away very fast before you have to do checking buildings at nights and thongs. The Orsay Math Department is actually going to build a new building. I mean, we are now in the process of discussing with the architect and so on, and it's a scary prospect now. The other thing is that, of course, in 20 years, you know, many things change. I see myself changing. In those days, I felt like this was really, you know, the far end of the world, you know, to having to walk all the way from the center of Cambridge. And nowadays, I feel like it's very good for my health to walk a little bit and to go back and forth. And actually, I would miss it, you know. That, you know. And and of course, people come and go. And I have two maybe anecdotes to tell about my first arrival at the Institute. The first time I came, I was as I was told, sort of one of these first European postdocs in those times. At that time, they were mostly famous for being overpaid. I don't know for those of you who remember that. I was doing this as part of my military service, French military service, and the idea was that it was a way to do it for to help underdeveloped countries. And my first encounter with Peter Godard was basically when I had to go and have a paper, a very important paper, signed by him, because otherwise, you know, the paperwork would not be processed by the French military administration. And basically, he had to sign things like completely absurd things like if he agrees that I do not need any other immunization than yellow fever for the country I'm going to live in. That was one. So yellow fever, I had to be immunized before coming over here. And also all sorts of instructions about what would happen if there would happen to be a war between England and France, and what in that case, you know, what that he would agree that I take refuge in the embassy and so on and so on. And I, you know, I was a young postdoc. Yes. Well. Anyway, so I was a young postdoc and I was coming to this director of this institute that I had heard before about, because it was mainly famous, instantaneously famous in France for having blackboards in the men's room as sort of the big innovation and anyway, so and I had to have that, you know, director of that big institution show these absurd papers and have him sign them. And it was very nice because obviously he already had two years, you know, of preparation of circumventing administrative, problems. So he looked at it. He certainly doesn't remember. I guess he was very tired and doesn't remember me in those times. But and then looked at this and, oh, these French. And then he signed. And I felt this was, very nice. So now I slowly have to move on to the more mathematical part of the lecture, and I'll try to use mostly the blackboard. And don't worry, I will not write any formula on it either. So maybe I need to start apologizing for this title I gave. This title sounds, philosophical, something. The type of title I run away from when I'm an audience, I feel that, I don't want to hear that, that type of, okay. So don't worry, I will try not to do this sort of meta, pseudo-mathematical stuff. I just want to show you, some aspects of that are really easy to grasp, at least in terms of what this progress that has been going on in recent years in the topic I'm going to talk about in a moment is about, in some sense, which is finding or exploring some mysterious aspect of their interplay between randomness and the continuum, and how randomness can be spread or cannot be spread in the continuum. And so I will try to make this less maybe mysterious, this type of statement. And before that, maybe I should start with just a little remark, which was that historically, so now don't worry, this is sort of pseudo historical things, but this will not last long. Historically, in early 20th century, there were simultaneously discussions about, inventing quantum mechanics. There were all these logic, Gödel's incompleteness theorems, and also the sound mathematical grounds for measure theory. And measure theory and probability theory, it's just the same parts of mathematics, at least in terms of the mathematical foundations. And the big debate was, you know, in measure theory was how do we describe, I mean, what setting do we use in order to describe the sets for which we can define the, that we can measure this, the mass of, right? So, and the big sort of, the you know, postulate that later became very widely accepted and that now we teach to our first year students, you know, as that's the way it is, young men, which is basically that sigma algebra, so which is basically the set of events that you can describe, roughly speaking, or that you can describe the probability of, is stable under, you know, countable, taking the intersection of countably many sets and taking the union of countably many sets. And if you think about it, this just means that you are able to observe simultaneously countably many things, right? That, that our mathematical brain is made tailored in such a way that we know that, you know, simultaneously we can observe countably many events and take the intersection of them. So of course we need to do that if we want to say something about, say, we can observe a, you know, a sequence, you know, a random sequence or something like that. And then of course, you know, sometimes students or not mathematicians, or, you know, they already said, but wait a minute, you toss an infinite number of coins and then you say something, but you cannot toss an infinite number of coins. That's, you know, not possible. And say, yes, but... And so there is this postulate that one starts with and immediately runs into sort of problematic things like, you know, there are... So this defines, you know, say, for instance, Borel subsets, I mean, the set of Borel sets in, of the interval 0, 1. And this immediately, you run immediately into things related to the axiom of choice, saying that there are subsets of 0, 1 for which one can prove that we don't know whether we can measure them or something like that, right? So immediately you run into the fact that you start with this postulate, you say, we can observe, you know, simultaneously, countably many things. So then the question is, what can we observe? You know, well, we don't exactly know, right? Because then you have to, we don't, it's sort of a sigma algebra generated by something is the smallest sigma, I mean, set of events that is stable under countable intersection and contains the things that we can obviously observe, but then we don't exactly know what we do actually construct in this way. So it raises the question that we don't exactly know what we are able to observe, what are the events that we are able to compute the probability of, you know, there is some mystery behind that. And a byproduct of this is, in a way, the fact that, and I don't want, you know, to do a sort of zero-level measure theory course that, like I would do with my first-year students, because this would take me sort of more than, you know, more than the hour. So, but a consequence of that, that is that any probability space, you know, any random thing on which you want to define probability is actually constructed or can be constructed by you do a countable number of coin tosses, right? That's what you start with. And you construct the rest out of those countably many coin tosses, independent coin tosses. That's the idea, that any, you know, probability or measure theoretical thing that makes sense is actually just countably many coin tosses, and then, okay, maybe you can construct the you know, the random, you know, intricate structure out of those, but that's basically what it is about. So you always have in your initial toolbox just countably many coin tossing and nothing else. And then you might say, well, this is not true. I know a random object which is not, you know, just countably many coin tosses, and we think of Brownian motion, you know, the trajectory that you've heard of, you know, this random function that is like that. And you say, this is not, you know, I'm choosing a random function. I'm not choosing countably many coin tosses because it's, you know, the space. But then you say, no, it's not the case because this is a precisely because this is a continuous function. And a continuous function, if you know a priori it's going to be continuous, then it suffices to know its value on the dyadics. Right? So you are constructing a countable family of random numbers, and then it so happens that this countable family of random numbers that you construct can be extended into a continuous function. Okay? So here we already see that this is not contradictory, the fact that you can construct random continuous objects. Nevertheless, they are all, in the background, they are just done by, constructed by random coin tosses. And for those of you, you might actually explicitly use coin tosses and using random Fourier series or something where to construct the Brownian motion, directly in a very direct way using these countable number of coin tosses. So that's just an example of it that illustrates somehow the how poor, right, probability theory is, right, at first glance, because we are just, the rule of the game is do whatever you can with countable coin tosses and try to explain to the other parts of mathematics that this has to do with what they are doing, and that you can explain, many structures or things in physics or whatever is around us with these countably many coin tosses. And in a way, a lot of the nice things that have been going on, including, I'm going to say just a word about sort of stochastic calculus in a moment, has been, with the way to describe these continuous objects, random objects that you can define, and to play with the, have this interplay between this continuum, here time, continuous time, and the fact that nevertheless you are dealing with a probability space, and therefore something for which you can measure probability of events. So, just, little thing I want to mention here is that one way, once you have drawn a Brownian path, right, sort of a Brownian motion like this, this is a random function b of t. And in a way, for each, one way to interpret it is to say that for each, say, interval here, a, you can say, well, actually what has happened is that there is an increment of the Brownian motion on this interval, right? That is basically the value at the end minus the value at the beginning, and that you can say that the increment of the Brownian motion on A, you can view this as some random, random impulse, right? That is going to be independent of the random impulse that takes place here. And so that so what I'm doing now is sort of trying to say that Brownian motion is what we like to call white noise is the same, is that you have this random, you can view this as something that for each domain A, right, sort of each domain A, let's call it, each interval A to start with, you can define sort of the total increment on A, and therefore you can try to do the same also for when A is sort of union of intervals or a more complicated object. You can start, saying, let's count twice the increments of the Brownian motion here plus once the increments of the Brownian motion here. This is going to define another random number. And in a way, you can try to do a similar thing than Brownian motion in the plane, for instance, or in the space. So the idea would be to say that I have a portion of the blackboard, say here a square. Okay. And then to each piece of the plane, right, you're going to associate just the increment of, the random impulse, whether you try to go up or down, that has happened in A. One way would be just to say, well, we have this quantity that to each set A associates, whether you tend to go, the total amount of impulses that happened in A make you go up or down. And then you use your favorite bijection, measure-preserving bijection from the interval on the square, right? So that to an interval of size something associates a portion of the plane of size of area, of the same area, and then you just say, well, the impulse that has happened here is just corresponding to the impulse that of the pre-image of that portion of the plane in the interval here. Right? So this is basically what I'm saying here with this description of random impulses, is this idea that in the Brownian path here, what is going on, I'm just mentioning it because it will be in contrast to what I want to tell you a bit later on, in this Brownian path, what is going on is that in some way the, you know, the randomness that constructs this random path is sort of spread continuously on the real axis. You know, it's you have your box of everything, or you know, that is going on, and then you just, you know, like a piece of sand, you put plus minus impulses a bit over all over the place, and the Brownian motion basically is scanning all this, is collecting everything, you know, all the impulses it sees, and then moves up or down depending on what you have here. And so what I'm basically telling you is sort of you know, the basic intuition, or what we like to call stochastic calculus, right? This idea that you scan and you collect all these random impulses that come over along with this. But you can make the same type of picture in the plane, that you have your randomness is sort of, you know, these little plus minuses impulses are, you know, spread in the plane, and that when you want to look at the total impulse that you have here, you just collect what you see there, and in some way this impulse is sort of thrown in the continuum in a nice way. And so before moving on, I just want to mention a little, or maybe I don't need to change blackboards, this I can erase. So just completely different story, and then we'll see later what I have in mind trying to make these things come together. So before showing you a picture, I mean a little telling you another story, I start with the following story. This is what we like to call Galton-Watson trees, but it's you have an individual at generation 0, and that individual has a random number of children. Okay. Let's say 0, 1, 2, or 3. And or maybe actually, maybe let's just say 0, 1, or 2. Okay. And this happens at random, following a certain law. And this law basically can be that in average, that person has 1.3 children, right? It has a certain probability to have 2 children, certain probability to have 1, certain probability to have 0. And in average, the mean value of this random experiment is going to be 1.3 or 9/8 or something like that, something larger than 1. So what happens if you do this, so let's call this M is the mean number of children of that person. So of course it may happen that that person has no children, and then the genealogical tree is finished, but then, okay, it may happen that that person has 2 children, and then maybe that person, and now the rule of the game is that these two persons are just doing the same experiment again at the initial guy, following the same rule. So that person will maybe has no children, that person has 2, that person has 2, and so on, right? And you can go on. I mean, then, of course, the question is, can you go on forever or not? Or does the genealogical tree die out? Or, you know, it can always happen that it dies out. But, you know, does this go on forever or not? And it's a very simple fact that we like to teach when we teach so-called martingales, that if M is strictly larger than 1, so if the mean number of children is strictly larger than 1, then indeed you have a positive chance that the tree never ends, right? So that the genealogy descendants is infinite. And in addition, on top of that, what you know is that when the tree never ends, you know, when you are at a generation which, you know, very far down in the tree after n generations, then the number of individuals, you know, descendant of that person at that level will be of the order m to the n, which is, of course, you know, the mean also the same as roughly the order of magnitude of the mean number of children at the nth generation. If each generation multiplied by n, by m, then you are at the So this is sort of these are simple statements. And that was just, you know, to have in the back of your mind. Now, let's do the following experiment. So this is now, you have a little family with 3 members, and these 3 members are going to vote to decide on something. Okay. And you have 2 opinions, and what is going to happen is that each member of the family is basically tossing a coin to decide whether it's voting A or voting B. So whether it's voting, say, cross or circle. Okay, and then you just say, well, you do this experiment. So you with these three people, and the majority wins. Majority wins, and of course, you know what. So you just say these. You have your three experiments here, and majority wins. So basically, here they say, okay, result is a circle. And of course, because of the symmetry of the problem, you know, what's the probability that the result is a circle? Well, it's 1/2 because at the bottom everything was symmetric to start with. So you can exchange crosses in circles with probability 1/2. So each one has the same probability. I mean, the result outcome is going to be with probability 1/2. It's going to be a circle or a square. Or across. Now, little computation of that everybody in the room can do is saying, well, what's the probability that the person elected is elected by 2-1? You know, you can be elected either 2-1 or 3-0. Well, Pascal's, 1-3-3-1, so basically it tells you basically that the chances that you are elected 2-1 is 3/4. Okay, so the person, this family, three families out of four are going to choose their opinion in average by 2-1 rule. Now imagine that in fact we are looking at a pool of three families, and basically that this is the result, the random result with probability 1/2. That has been constructed by these three individuals, right? And similarly here. So obviously, this picture always has the same law because this guy will have been constructed with probability 1/2. It's a circle. With probability 1/2, it's a circle. With probability 1/2, it's a cross because they have been constructing using this random experiment from below, and the families don't talk to each other. So what you see here is basically that. You can do this picture with, nine people. You group them into three. And when you have nine people, you group them into three. And you just look at, each pack of three is, deciding what is going on here. Say 2-1 here, 3-0 here, and imagine 2-1 here. And then you get the results at next level. And then the three representatives go on and vote for the next system, at the next layer. And if I erase everything here, you can view this as if you would have only have three persons and in one family. And now, of course, you see me, coming with my big shoes, which is that, now you continue. These three guys have been also constructed by a picture like this. Okay. And now we have a picture where after, you draw the picture with n generations, and you have 3-n people at the bottom, so very large number of people. Each one is tossing a coin, and then you assemble them 3-3. You look at the outcome. You replace that pack by the outcome, and then you replace the 3-n-1 outcomes, and you put them, group them by 3, and so on. And then you have this iterative result, and at the end comes the final result that tells you the population has decided that the result is a circle. Now, what does this have to do with the previous story? It's the following. Now, look, I'm going to draw in blue here all the guys that have been elected 2-1. Each person here, each of these guys, if you look at this thing, has been elected 2-1 with a probability 3/4. So this guy's, and everything what happens here, here, and here is independent from each other. Right? So basically, each of these guys, if I erase this information, everything happens as if each of these guys tosses a coin of, and with probability 3/4, it has been elected 2-1. Because you know that here, the next layer guys have been chosen, at random. And so, therefore, this guy has been elected 2-1 with a probability 3/4. So I'm drawing in blue all the guys that are elected 2-1. Now,
looks like 3-0.
Okay. Some people are really following. That's very short. Okay, so now I don't want to spend too much time with that, but basically what is going to happen is that the fact that this guy has been elected 2-1 is actually independent of the fact whether this guy, which happens to be a cross, has been elected 2-1 or 3-0. So basically each of these guys, if you browse from top to bottom, has been elected 2-1 with a probability 3/4. Okay. And you do it like this. So now I'm going just to look at, I try to go down in my tree with the rule that this is a circle. Right? I'm looking among the children, I mean the voters who happen to be circles also. I'm just looking at those that have been elected 2-1. Right? This is a circle that has been elected 2-1. I look at it has two children which elected them, right? It has been elected 2-1, it has two children that have elected them, and then I draw these children in blue, maybe I choose another color. So this is the red guy, elected 2-1, it's a circle. I look at its two children that happen to be a circle, and I look at, only keep those that have been elected 2-1 themselves. And I go down like this. When you do this, what happens is that you start here, you go down, and what you're doing is exactly this picture where at each stage, this guy has been elected 2-1. It has either, how many red children can it have? 0, 1, or 2, depending on whether these guys have been elected 2-1 or not. Right? And each of these two guys have been elected 2-1 with a probability 3/4, and therefore the average number of red descendants of this red guy is 2 × 3/4, right? So it's something larger than 1. And therefore, what happens is that when you go down after, you do this experiment up to, a very, very large generation. I mean, a very, very, so here you have 3 to the n people all the way down. And what this tells you is that you have a positive chance, right, that out of the 3 to the n people, you have roughly 3/2 to the n. So roughly speaking, so it's very small proportion of people compared to 3 to the n, but still many, many people that actually, have a direct red path all the way up. And each of the 3 to the 3/2 to the n people say, well, I did decide because I voted circle, right? But if I would have chosen the cross, then the next thing that has been elected 2-1 would have been reversed, so I would have had a cross. And then the next thing would have been reversed also because it would have been elected 2-1. And therefore, if I would have changed my opinion, the final result would have been different, right? This is a very simple argument. So therefore, you have, at the end, this is very strange because you have 3 to the n people, each one tosses a coin. Here you have an outcome at the very end. And a very, very large number of people actually at the end have the impression that they decided, right? That they had the decision in their hands. You know, if they would have decided to, talk to their neighbors, if they would have known, what's the right thing to do, then, so you have 3/2 to the n people who feel very, very guilty here at the end. Right? And so here you have a completely different behavior of constructing this outcome out of the 3 to the n inputs. And of course, this is very different than the usual way, majority vote, where we say we count how many crosses, how many circles, and then we see who wins. It's very different because, of course, it's very nonlinear. That's the way it is. And therefore, it has this feature. And it has this feature that you have many people who have been selected somehow by the system to have all the information in their hands, but the way the selection itself and the voting combine, the voting itself is the way to select who in the end actually did decide things. So the usual voting system is, you know, something that gives rise to the Brownian motion. You have random inputs, you know, plus, minus, and you add them. These little, you know, influxes. This is basically telling you the opinion of a population, where you, each one of these people, you know, of these infinitesimal people, has voted plus or minus, and you go up or down depending on what happens, and you collect this information, and then at the end you see a Brownian motion. So the question is there some continuous natural version, you know, analog of continuous in the continuous world of this type of feature? Is there a way, you know, because of course you might say, well, of course there's no problem to define this in the continuum, but let's pass n to the limit, you know, and then, well, okay, you pass n to the limit, then you go from n to n plus 1, and so, but there's no, you know, there's no sand, you don't know exactly how to define the infinitesimal sand that would be there in order to, that would reconstruct this thing, other than just saying the sand, the definition of this random sand is the limit of what happens on the tree, and that, so, which would not be so thrilling. So this is now the story I want to tell you, which is basically that among the things that have happened in, you know, probability theory in the last 10, 15 years, and I happen to be involved not exactly in what I'm going to tell, but in related works, is provide actually the, you know, natural or candidate or of another way to construct mathematically the theory of a random structure like this, where somehow this outcome in the continuum, so you spread some randomness in the plane. You have to do it in the plane for this to really be able to grasp this. You throw some randomness in the plane, and then it constructs macroscopic features that have that type of behavior. So, you know, we all tend to think, you know, you all imagine things like, of course, you know, turbulence, and, you know, this comes out of these infinitesimal randomness and then propagates on macroscopic scale by some nonlinear, you know, mechanism, and this, you know, is very reminiscent of this type of feature, except that it's very hard to actually put one's hand, you know, on a really scale invariant mathematical, as simple as possible mechanism for which you can see this sort of upscale that happens in the continuum. And so the story, so maybe now is the time to show a picture. So, yes. That's a... I didn't look at the clock. When did I start exactly? Quarter past?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. So now you start seeing exactly the same picture I was sort of mentioning before, with this idea that, so this is the two-dimensional analog of the random walk, right? On each cell, hexagonal cell, you toss a coin to decide whether it's white or whether it's black. And the first, you know, picture here, you know, here you have the analog of, you know, of a Brownian motion that would be a random walk, where at each step you go down or up. So you toss a plus minus coin at each step. And you know that if, you know, if you look at the picture of a random walk on large scale, it looks like, appropriately normalized, looks like a Brownian motion. So here, basically, the picture that would correspond to spreading randomness uniformly in the plane would be nicely approximated by saying, well, let's take a very, very fine mesh. And for a domain A, we count plus 1 for black, minus 1 for white. So we look at what, you know, number of whites, black minus number of whites in the domain, appropriately normalized. This gives us a random number that would correspond to this collection of random impulses that you get when you do this linear collection of information, of random inputs. I told you, you know, everything is about, you have to start with coin tosses. So in a way, that's what we're doing now. And this picture, there's another way to look at this picture, which is just to look at it, you know, like some you know, if you would show this, or if you actually your own eyes, you know, are instinctive. Our instinct is to look at this picture and to start detecting shapes, right? You go to the you know, your favorite doctor, and he tells you, what do you see here? And then you say, well, I recognize all sorts of shapes, you know, and actually, now I remember my mother used to, and so on. Anyway. So you immediately try to look at this, and if you are trained, you know, if as a kid you have played, you know, little board games, you try to see, well, you know, is there a black path, you know, crossing or from left to right, and things like that. So now the point is that we don't worry about the number of whites minus number of blacks. We just look at who wins, you know, who's invading, who's invading things, and of course you want to do it here, right? And here our eyes are a bit less trained to actually see what happens. So both those who wear glasses and those who don't, because basically it's just our eyes don't see it. You try to follow things and then you are lost at some point. And you don't know. However, and so this is a familiar story that everybody has seen before, I guess in this context of what's called percolation, there are certain things that you know a priori. Imagine that in the previous shape, you cut out a rhombus like this, and you ask the following game, you know, you draw one side in black, one side in black, one side in white, one side in white, and you ask the question, you know, who wins? You know, does black connect to black, or does white connect to white? Yes, because either black connects to black, then white is not able to make it, or black doesn't, but that means that white did. So it's a win, you know, win-lose game. Well, you know that picture is completely symmetric. Everybody tosses a coin with probability 1/2. So actually, with probability 1/2, black wins, and with probability 1/2, white wins. And this is true at any scale. I haven't used the fact that this was a rhombus of a certain size. So therefore, in the previous picture, you know, I draw a rhombus, and with probability 1/2, I have a big, big black crossing from one side to the other, and with probability 1/2, I have a big, big white crossing from one side to the other. So whatever you do, because you have to do it using this rhombus tiling, I mean the tiling by hexagons, you will have long paths of one given color. Okay. So now I just want to make a little remark, which is a very simple, an additional remark, which is that here in that game, so I took a slightly larger one, and what you see here is that in this picture, all these guys with yellow dots, or maybe they're not yellow anymore if you see them from far away, but some white sites have dots, right? And each of these white sites with dots actually thinks, I decided, right? Because if any one of these dotted white cells would have been black, then black would have won. Now, the point is, I want to make now very briefly, is that this is actually true at any scale, that at any scale, you take a very large rhombus, and you have some chance of having plenty, plenty of yellow guys that said, actually, I decided, you know. So in this picture here, for instance, you don't see it, right? But you ask the question, is there a left to right crossing by black cells? Right? And with a very large probability, there will be plenty of yellow guys here. I mean, plenty of, you know, maybe you say it's not the case, there's a top-to-bottom crossing by white cells. And actually, you have a very large chance, and actually there are plenty of these white cells that are feeling exactly like those guys here, because they said, well, actually, if I would have been black, you know, I would have had the connection in the other direction, right? So these dotted guys, they are sort of what we like to call pivotal, because basically there's a white path, you know, passing through them, that joins the two white paths, and it neighbors two black paths that go to the other direction, right? So that if this guy would have been black, then you would construct this black path here. So let me just tell you why, and this is, you know, not a new story. I mean, you know, these ideas that I'm going to present now sort of go back quite a while, and of course one of the big heroes of this theory is called Harry Keston. And so the idea is that you can actually show that typically, you know, with a little bit like in, if like in the configuration of this genealogical tree, there's this positive probability that there will be plenty, you know, white sites feeling very guilty because they actually think they decided the whole thing. And the reason is very simple. In order to find, you know, let's do the experiment in two steps. So here I have my rhombus like this. And in order to see if there is a, you know, crossing, a blue crossing from here to here, what you're going to do is you're just following the boundary of all the black, so imagine here, you're going to follow the boundary of the black island that's touching the top left corner here, the top left boundary, right? So here in that picture, you're going to do something like, you know, you're exploring something like this, and then, bop, you're here. But when you follow this boundary, by definition, you have, you know, one color on one side, and because it's the boundary, and because of you are playing with the hexagonal shapes, on the other side, you have a path of the other color, right? So you're following an interface between white and black here. And here, because you end up on this side before, well, you have detected a blue crossing from here to here. And if this random path hits this path before, that means it has been blocked by a red crossing from here to there. And this blue crossing, in a way, it's the, you know, it's the one that is furthest to the, I mean, the closest you can make it to the top left corner is to follow the boundary of this black island that is touching the corner. Okay, so you have a probability 1/2 to have a picture like this when you discover a blue path from here to there. Right? So you have your random experiment, and then you have sent in little robot that is sort of exploring the boundary here. But this little robot has not explored anything about what is going on here. So now in the remaining, and now you say, well, okay, in this remaining picture, maybe you reboot your system, and now in this remaining picture, maybe there is a, would a, you know, if I reboot everything, there would be a crossing from here to here by, okay, by a red chalk. And therefore, here in this remaining part here, there's a probability at least 1/2 to have a red path that goes from here to here that would be the beginning of, you know, a resampling of the entire thing, having a path from here to there. And the point where you hit here, this is a guilty guy, right? So with probability 1/4, you have a guilty guy here because probability 1/2 to have this, 1/2 to, at least 1/2 to have that. And that one is very, feeling very guilty because it was blue, it made blue win. But if it would have been red, okay, then red would have won. So this tells you that you have a positive chance of having at least one guilty person. And a little bit of work tells you that actually there will be at least logarithmic number of such guilty people, because basically if this happens, that somehow you can try to construct, you know, little arms at any scale. So I don't want to go into the details, but basically construct that if there's one guilty guy, it's likely that there are quite a bunch of other guilty people sitting next to him. You actually see it already here that, you know, when there's one dot, yellow dot, you tend to have quite a number, the neighbors tend to be yellow, I mean, have more chances of being yellow as well. So what happens is that in this percolation picture, when you let the mesh size go to zero, so basically when you look at this picture here, and you look at the family of all possible macroscopic connections that you see here, then these outcomes will be of a similar type, you know, the way you construct these macroscopic paths like this are somewhat similar to what was underneath here, which basically was the fact that you had this nonlinear propagation of information that made many people at the end have the impression that they are the ones that had all the information. If you want to make it completely, you know, translation invariant or something, you might either look at the picture in the entire plane, or you might look at, you know, the picture on the torus. You know, just view this this rectangle like a video game where when you go up, you come back down again. You know, this is these cheap tricks we learn when we teach to introduce geometry to our new students. Anyway, so and then you have a completely translation invariant picture, and where you have randomness constructed out of microscopic inputs. So the question is, does this thing have a limit? Right? Is there a continuous model of that? Can you say, can you let the mesh of the lattice go to zero? Then the random paths, the random interface connections will... Okay. Music is starting already. I have to... No, it's fine, it's fine. I didn't mean to. Okay. So the question is there a continuous object behind the scene that is basically corresponding to the scaling limits, like the Brownian motion is with respect to the random walk? Is there a continuous structure where the randomness is sort of coming out of nowhere in the plane and with this upscaling mechanism? And the answer is yes. And so maybe actually we can put the screen up again, if yes. And so I'm just going to state the results. So the formal results, of course, I'm going to state can be found in a paper by two of our heroes in that area, which is Oded Schramm and Stas Smirnov. And that's a paper that they were writing and debating on how to write when Oded died in this hiking accident. And basically, the statement is extremely simple. It just says the following. There is a probability space, right? That means there's a way to construct something random, and such that for each set A in the plane, so for each domain A in the plane, you have what we like to call a sigma field, FA, which is basically the collection of everything that you can observe by looking at the picture in A. Okay? So for any subset of the plane, you erase the information of the random of this random black and white infinitesimal thing, and you just look at what you see in A. That's the collection of all the random events that happen in A. If you have the scaling limit of this thing, what you have is the following. What do you want? You want that if A and B are independent, are disjoint, you want that what happens here and what happens there is independent. That's obvious because the coin tossing depend on different different places. So you want if this, you need FA and FB to be independent. Basically, everything you can observe here is independent of everything you can observe there. This is true for any A and B, right? So you have a collection of observables, and these are independent. What else do you want? Well, you want that basically F A union B is generated by the information you get in A and the information you get in B. So something like sigma of F A union F B. Right? So imagine that we are able to construct the scaling limit of when the lattice mesh goes to zero. Then we would expect that indeed there is this random probability space that describes this sort of infinite collections of out of these infinitesimal stuff that has these two properties and that is scale invariant because you have let the mesh of the lattice go to zero. So basically the law of what you observe in a square is the same as the distribution of what you would observe in the twice larger square scaled down to the smaller square. Right? So you have something like scale invariant. So of course, scale invariance is sort of scale invariance and translation invariance. Right? If you shift the entire picture by something, in law you see the same. If you blow up the entire picture by factor 2, you see the same picture. Okay, so these are type of simple questions, and the person, of course, who asked these nasty questions, he's one of my personal heroes, and you see, so Boit Sillerson who basically asked, is there another, things that satisfy these type of objects that would be different than, intrinsically different than these collection, that the white noise, the collection of, of things that you spread and collect linearly. And in particularly, so he was looking for something that he called black noise. I'm going to cheat slightly, but basically the idea is the following. If you think a little bit about what I just said about the yellow dots, right? In the large scale, when the mesh of the lattice goes to zero, the number of yellow dots typically tends to infinity because there are more and more of them. Now, imagine that you sample your picture, and then at random, you choose 0.2% of the cells, and 0.2% of the cells, you resample them. These guys, these 0.2% resample. Or another way to put it is actually, for a tiny proportions of those of the cells in the plane, you actually got it wrong. You read black, it was white, or somebody cheated, or I don't know. But basically, you read it wrong. Well, if the number of these yellow dots tends to infinity, in these 0.2% of guys that you resample, you will have typically yellow dots. And therefore, the answer is sort of changed. So what happens in this percolation picture, and this is sort of an older result by Kalai, Schramm, and Benjamini, is saying basically in the large-scale limit, if you do the percolation picture, a very large box, you resample 0.2%, then what you see has nothing to do with the reality. Because you will have resampled, you will have changed yellow dots, but also actually yellow dots at any scale. So you will have changed the definition of who the yellow dots actually are, right? So as long as if you sample only 99.8% of the cells, you still have zero information about what is going on, because basically in the remaining stuff, you will have some of the yellow dots that you still have to sample. And so the idea is basically here that in this sigma field, in this definition, when you basically say what is the influence of what this guy of a very, very small piece here has on the global result, it is completely different than the standard way. So I'm not going to decide to describe this a bit more, but basically it's just exactly what this sort of noise sensitivity type is related to this noise sensitivity type feature I've described. And basically, you want something satisfying all this, plus this sort of noise sensitivity feature, right? And the point is that in this paper by Schramm and Smirnov, basically, they prove the existence of this, random problem, this probability space indexed by these things, where you have exactly that corresponds to the scaling limit of the previous one, that has exactly this, continuous collection, out of the random stuff spread in the continuum. You have this sort of tree, of random tree of people deciding at every scale, yellow dots at every scale, which have all the information in hand. They have been selected randomly by their environment, but they have the information, and then you have all this upscale information that is telling you what you have here. And there's a nice paper by Schramm and Garbon and Gabor Pete, who are two of our latest Roger Davidson Prize winners, not this year, but the year before, who actually, together with Schramm, basically, use very, very, they describe variations about this. And the only thing I want to say, of course, is that behind the scene, that you have a 100-page Acta Mathematica paper, the Garbon and so on paper, because you need to use heavy technology in order to master these things. And one of these technologies has to do, and this corresponds to the fact that we can only do this mathematically right now in the plane. It has to do the, basically to cut it short, that the plane is the set of complex numbers, that the complex numbers, they are is a nice things, because you can multiply them, and that you can use complex analysis basically, and what, Smirnov, you probably heard that he proved conformal invariance of the pictures that I've described before. So you have to use this conformal invariance machinery and etc. in order to master all this business and to construct this random probability space. But in a way, it sort of reflects to us something sort of deeper about when maybe, you know, now I'm back to my pseudo-philosophical nonsense. Well, two things. The first is when we try to think ourselves, you know, how is a random event constructed? You know, what is it? Okay, it's either, you say, it's a discrete thing, I toss a coin. Or it's made out of, you know, plenty of infinitesimal impulses. And in a way, when you modelize what happens around you, say, in a, you know, in physics or in a gas or, you know, all these, then in most cases, actually, what we like to think is that the way these little, you know, random things that we observe around us are not really in the realm of this stochastic calculus, but they are more, you know, in this other, you know, sort of upscale, nonlinear business. So, don't worry, Chris, I'm not going to say anything about math finance that has been using stochastic calculus a lot. And the point is that these things, you know, we're mathematically quite poor. You see, we're just able to construct the probability space and we are super happy. And you know, to say that actually, you know, the way, you know, things work in real life or in biology or something has had probably to do with more with that type of propagation of information out of nowhere. Okay, but nevertheless, this tells us, this is, I think, a typically mathematical satisfaction in the sense that you have this sort of introspection of, you know, we look at this infinitesimal, you know, way to construct random things out of the continuum, and the interplay for those of us in some way, you know, who liked to play board games as children, who liked, you know, to throw dices, and who liked, you know, to look at stars and to think about infinity and continuous functions and so on. Well, not as continuous functions as kids, of course, but, you know, about this notion, and who liked mathematics because of this infinity being there and to, you know, imagining, dreaming of things. This is a nice way to basically connect these two things, and in a way it's also the fine understanding of this precise mechanism is also, you know, shedding some light on the more general, you know, outside world and the general mechanisms that are in place. Okay, so I'm over time as usual, and I thank you for your attention.
Vendelin, thank you so much for giving us a small insight into very simple problems that are in fact very deep, and how deep mathematics begins to resolve them. And I know that this is very, very cutting-edge stuff, and it's nice to have an insight into it. Thank you very much. We'll now go to the next part of our afternoon's celebrations. If you charge your glasses, and Howard Covington, the chair of our management committee, will present some Lord Rees of Ludlow, I should say, with his honorary fellowship of the Newton Institute. Once you've had a drink. So please thank the speakers once again.